The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benroot from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, we will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
This is Dan Oliver reading An Historic Rejection by Mark Brian Thomas. I suppose writers are like gamblers or fishermen. We loudly celebrate our triumphs and conveniently bury the failures. I'd made a point of mentioning a rare bit of success to an elderly neighbor of mine who also fancied himself a writer. A popular science fiction website had finally accepted one of my stories about a robot obsessed with Gustav Klimt's early paintings. And they were even going to pay for the privilege of stroking my ego. We were eating breakfast at our favorite diner when I casually let the news drop. My neighbor immediately asked me to submit one of his efforts under my name. He had offered several stories to the same website, but theorized they had been rejected unread. My new status as a contributing author would provide the entree his genius needed to be appreciated. I magnanimously agreed to look at a story, and he surprised me by immediately pulling some papers out of his jacket pocket. I read while we finished our coffee. "What do you think?" he asked. "Well," I said judiciously, "it presents some problems. This particular website specifically warns against submitting stories containing racism, chauvinism, excessive violence, or gratuitous sexual activity, and you've managed to spectacularly violate all of those norms within four pages." He pursed his lips. "One could argue they are integral to the story. Not many people truly appreciate the flavor of those times." "I suppose, but the site also has an injunction against specific overworked plot devices. The website mentions, tongue-in-cheek, of course, not to send them stories about time traveling to kill Hitler, and that's exactly what you've done." "No!" The old man was shocked. "My story is the exact opposite. Hitler's scientists, the most brilliant minds of the century, Schroeghold, Blohm, Rudolf, von Braun, have constructed a time machine in the Führer bunker, and the leader is able to escape the degradation and weakness of that era to live a life of artistic contemplation in our modern age. A bony fist hit the table and rattled our cups." I tried to be conciliatory. "Well, perhaps the publishers are just prejudiced against certain attitudes toward time travel, those that assume historical changes can be made with surgical precision. They like stories where unintended consequences overwhelm the protagonist." I returned the papers. "I'm sorry, but I just can't submit this." The old man huffed and rubbed the white patch of mustache over his quivering lip. He seemed on the verge of continuing the argument, of offering proof positive that his understanding of time and history was correct, but suddenly retreated into quiet, unobtrusive civility. "Thank you for your frankness," he said to me. "No problem." My neighbor rose and slowly walked back to his apartment while I enjoyed another cup of coffee. It was surprisingly satisfying to see life from the other side of the desk and deliver a disappointing verdict rather than receive it. One could easily get used to that sort of thing.
I'm Warren Keyes, and I'll be reading The Widow Anatolia and the Dragon Lord, written by Jamie Lackey. The widow Anatolia stands in front of her stovetop, her bare feet cold against the tile floor. She splashes water into a small pot without measuring, then dumps half of it down the drain. She stands over it while it comes slowly to a boil, enjoying the heat that wafts up and caresses her cheeks. Outside, snow crunches under heavy boots, A sharp knock echoes through her house. She is wearing layers of clothing under a ratty bathrobe, and piles of clutter form unsteady towers on any unused space. She doesn't remember the last time she washed her hair. The knock sounds again, even sharper. She answers it, expecting one of her well-meaning friends or maybe someone selling vacuums. Instead, the Dragon Lord stands on her stoop, wearing his human form and holding two coffees in bright red to-go cups. The widow Anatolia blinks at him. He blinks back. The cold wind gusts, and Anatolia shivers and steps back. The Dragon Lord steps inside and closes the door behind him. He holds out one of the cups of coffee, and Anatolia takes it. "It's been a long time," he says. He does not look at the mess or her unwashed hair. His dark eyes bore into hers. "Yes, I was just making breakfast. Would you like some?" She thinks of herself as the widow Anatolia as a reminder. It keeps her from shouting questions at the empty house, from making twice the food she needs. With the Dragon Lord sitting at her table, sipping his coffee while she adds water back to the pot, she doesn't need a reminder. She sips her own coffee. He's added cream and sugar, and it is perfect.
"I'm sorry for your loss," he says eventually. "I wanted to come to the funeral, but I was away on business."
She nods. She remembers his responsibilities, how often they made him an empty shape in her life. She stirs dry oats into boiling water. She isn't lonely with him sitting behind her. They finish their coffee before the oatmeal is cooked, so she makes tea. The snow on his boots has melted, leaving a cold puddle around his feet. She moves a stack of magazines and sits in the other chair. She wonders why he's come, but doesn't ask. They eat in silence. Then she rinses their bowls and adds more water to their teacups. She can think of only one reason for him to be here, but she can't quite believe it. She drinks her tea and waits.
"Years ago, you refused me."
The words are addressed to his half-empty teacup.
"Your reasons were good. Your logic sound."
Anatolia nods. "It was the right choice." She is comfortable in this knowledge, happy with where that path had taken her.
"If I ask you again, would that still be the case?"
"Are you asking?"
"You know I am."
She stares into his eyes. "Let's go outside." She leads him to the back door, shoves her feet into a pair of worn, fur-lined boots. There is a high fence around the back garden, and the snow has flattened the plants that she let go untended all summer. There is just enough space here for him to transform, and he does, between heartbeat and the next. His scales are brilliant red against the whites and grays and browns. His body radiates soft heat like a banked fire. His eyes are the same, dark and intense and focused on her.
"Come with me," he says. "I will take you away to my tower."
Years ago, when he asked the first time, her refusal had been planned and rehearsed. It had been the right choice then. She could refuse again, go back inside and wash her dishes and tidy up her apartment and take a long hot shower. But this time, she steps forward and puts a cold hand against the Dragon Lord's warm, scaly cheek. He sags into her touch, his relief a palpable force. There is nothing in the apartment that she will miss. "Take me home," Anatolia says. The Dragon Lord nods and does.
This is Dan Oliver reading Angel Unplugged by Dale and Christine Hansen. The cyborg was positively throbbing. I could feel the bass in my chest, and my bones rattled so heavily with the beat that I felt I was going to fly apart any minute now. Who would miss me if I did? Flixers wouldn't care, and the Trappets sure as hell wouldn't notice. Besides, the night outside was still dripping from the constant rains that washed the shit down the gutters and made the pedestrians crouch into themselves like dark turtles looking for an empty hole. The cyborg, on the other hand, was one of those holes. Brightly lit nanos crawled over the walls and each other, each one flashing a different color. Together, they spelled out the day's specials, the drink of the day that the bar was pushing, and provided background pulses of rapid, eye-gouging color that assaulted vision like the music assaulted hearing. I waved my wrist over the reader and waited until the club was assured I had enough in my account to cover admission. Once through the door, I cranked the tunes harder, passed the mandatory safety warnings, and tried to blow out my ears. There was a chick in front of me, long flying hair whipping around. The adage was, if you can't dance, jump. And she was gaining air. She was also plugged into a guy next to her, doing it on the dance floor. That's what I loved about Cyborg. Human operated or not, there were no rules. Behind them, two Gilas at the bar were totally plugged into each other, jacks camouflaged in tattooed lizards that crawled relentlessly, restlessly over their arms and into their clothes. One shivered, her bony arms hugged against her as though only just noticing that it was winter outside, and the cold still blossomed in joints like this. Behind them, a nice-looking little catch sitting at the bar alone. Why no one had plugged her in, I couldn't figure. I made my smoothest move. I walked up and pulled the wire from my arm implant and offered her the jack. She refused. Okay, so I'm not her type. What do I care? I'll find someone else. Only her hand is on mine, like really close to the implant. Not a good thing. But she's cute, and she's saying something. I turn the sound down and yell, "What? Maybe we can talk," she yells back at me. I'm up for anything once. What the hell? About what? Then this chick reaches over and touches my implant. Just like that. No permission, no consent. Just grabs it and looks at me and turns it off. Off. No music. Nothing shattering my bones. There are lights flashing everywhere, people jumping up and down. But now, without sound, it's surreal. Almost sinister. I've been dropped into a hole, and everyone else didn't notice. The smell of sweat and old alcohol is overwhelming. And frankly, Cyborg looks like a dingy pit crawling with nanolice like dots of light trapped in their own dance. Maybe we can talk this time? I turn around, and I'm remembering this girl. The implant had clouded my memory. It's been clouding a lot of things lately, but that's what comes of running it with no filters. But it's coming back to me, sending out beacons and distress signals that this girl is dangerous, like heavy monstrous dangerous. And still, I ignore it because once upon a time, she'd saved my life, and that offsets a lot of crazy. Angel? Hello, Stiv. I drop onto the stool next to her. I can't face her, but she lays her hand on mine and smiles. It's a sad smile, but it's a smile. I know what she's going to ask before she does. I swallow hard and decide I might as well cut to the chase and get this over with. She could leave, and I could, well, whatever the hell I've been doing. I couldn't leave it off, I whisper to the bar. It's okay. You came back to me. That's what matters. And just like that, she leans in and kisses my cheek. Technophobe, but I love her. I look into her eyes so she knows I do, even if I'm not good at getting out the words. I need her to know it's true. But I can't go any further. My lips seal shut, locked down without consent. Some things you're just programmed not to say. But I feel every ache and pain. I see the mold and the rot and the hair and the cocktails. I swallow hard. I don't think I can stay. You say that every time. She smiles, but there's a sad look in her eyes as she leans in and kisses me again, this time on the mouth, lips lingering just long enough to stir old emotion and panic as she stands up to leave. Angel! She's looking at me, but someone on the dance floor has grabbed her wrist. He has a jack ready, but, of course, he can't find a plug. Angel doesn't have one. He's confused. I see the frustration on his face, the beginnings of fear. And just like that, I know who I am. I don't need implants. I don't need any of this. Rot and mold and stray hairs fester in my soul the longer I stay plugged in. What if I choose her instead? Could someone without code fill the void in the subroutine? I start toward her, her name on my lips, hand outstretched. She reached for me, meeting me halfway. Her smile lights up the room more than a trillion nanos ever could. It's because of me. I made that smile. It's all for me. I take her hand, freely given, and pull her out into the musty street. It's not easy, she whispers in my ear. I can hear the trepidation warring with excitement. The city throbs around us, but for once, I'm not a part of it. It's a strange, scary feeling. At least I have an angel to light my way, I murmur, reaching for her, hand cupping her face, drawing her close for another kiss, and another after that. She smiled again. I think the sun rose and burned away the mist. I wasn't sure. Angel's fingers found mine, twining them through her own. It was like being jacked in, but warmer somehow. The world changed.
Hi, this is Lynn Burla, and I'm going to be reading Mombot Isn't Happy by Philip Wilkren. Our Mombot isn't happy. Bots can't be happy, says Nier. He's stupid, for all of him being 8. Can too, I tell him. You laugh when you're happy, and Mombot can laugh. Nier sticks his nose up like he's trying to play a plane-spotting game on his contact lenses, but he's not. Mombot, he says, laugh. Ho, 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 says our Mombot. It's not a real laugh. It sounds like a Santa from the store, and I can tell Mombot isn't happy. It's mean to make someone laugh when they're not happy. Nier is stupid. I like our Mombot. It's big and red, like a Coke logo, and it's got 4 legs so it doesn't fall over when we play in the yard. Sometimes it leaves tracks, small holes where the grass is all flat, like a real elephant, and I get to look for them. I like it when Mombot plays with me. Nobody else does. Don't worry, I tell it. We'll make you better. And then I hug it. Mombot hugs back, and its arms are smooth and hard and cold. Dad, I say, Mombot isn't happy. We're eating curly fries and soy sticks, and the table is full of yellow crumbs. I mush them with my thumbs. Dad keeps reading his contacts. The little green dots keep scrolling in his eyes. Dad, I say. Go play with it. It likes that, Dad says. It's probably a software glitch, says Mom. I'll schedule an upgrade. Mom, I almost shout, then remember that Mom hates shouting. Mom, I say, all quiet, I want to play with our Mombot like it is. Mom shrugs and unpauses her contacts. The letters keep blinking in her eyes, and she looks like she isn't here. We'll get a new model soon anyway, she says. I press my mouth shut with my hands. Mom is going to kill Mombot. I hug Mombot's arm. Tight. Tight. It's dark. I should be sleeping, but I'm not. Tears burn my eyes and roll down onto Mombot's carapace. "There, there, little one," Mombot says, patting me on the back. Mombot is going to go into the recycling. I have killed Mombot. Dawn is when the lights in near in my room go bright. They start dark, then red, like Mombot's skin, then pink, and then you don't see them because everything is its own color. That's when it's time to get up and go eat breakfast. The window screens open, and the Coke logo on the roof next door shines into our room. Mombot tells us to go downstairs. Near goes, after Mombot promises him a Choco Coke and a new game for his contacts. But I stay. "Mombot," I say, "are you happy?" "I am always happy with you," says Mombot. I think about it. "Aren't you happy with Near?" "With both of you," says Mombot, but it doesn't laugh. That is bad. If Mombot doesn't laugh, Mom will kill it. "You're right," says Dad at breakfast. "The bot's demeanor has changed lately." "Might be a virus," says Mom. She chews on a cheese bun that Mombot made, her fingers waving in the air, flicking data across her contacts, making her eyes flame. "Big attack last week," she says. "Nothing about our model being affected, but they never tell you everything in the news." "Oh, better take it to the shop," says Dad. "It's getting old, anyhow." "They're going to kill our Mombot." "Mombot," I say. The door is locked. The window screens are down. Near is away in the teach room. Mom and Dad are working. We are alone, Mombot and I. "Please be happy," I say. "I am happy, loveling," Mombot says. "Please be a little more happy," I say. My throat hurts and the words sound all choked. Mombot starts to sing. "I'm a little teapot, nice and small. It is trying to make me happy. That is wrong. I cannot be happy when Mombot is going to the recycling." "Mombot," I say. "Mombot. It is wrong to make someone laugh when they're sad." "Mombot," I say, "please laugh." "Ho, ho, ho," says Mombot. It sounds wrong. I try to smile at Mombot. "Are you happy, little one?" My smile trembles. "Yes," I lie. "Then I am happy too," says Mombot. At dinner, we both smile and say, "Ho, ho, ho." And Mombot isn't sent to the recycling, but something inside of me is.
I'm Leon Shargle, and I'm going to read you the story The Alien and 36B by Jennifer Stephan Caprell. The blood beneath the alien's aquaskin rippled in waves. His immune system operated in overdrive, fighting all the microbes recirculating throughout the aircraft. The woman next to him in 36C kept coughing into her hand and then moving wrinkled magazines around on her tray table. Vibrant green and neon orange specks surrounded her, covered the table, and occasionally floated near him to mix with other specks in the air. He was trying very, very hard not to create an incident. Flying in a human airplane was not his first choice of transport, but as an experienced diplomat, he knew he had to attempt to live like a human, and today that meant traveling with the masses on a germ-infested, antiquated aircraft. "Nice weather," said the woman in 36C. The alien steeled himself, anticipating an insult. "Indeed," he replied, carefully choosing each word. "Hopefully we won't have any delays." "Were you in New York long?" the woman asked, between coughs and green particles flying. "No," said the alien, shuddering at the thought of traveling to New York again any time soon. The objects were way too bright, covered in layers and layers of robust bacteria. He lost his balance while riding in the subway and was forced to grab onto a rail that was sticky. He spent most of his visit disinfecting and trying to deflect all the abuses yelled at him in the street. He remembered it was polite to ask a question in return. "How about you?" The woman described her monthly commute to see her granddaughter in Queens and how she wished her daughter would move to D.C. The daughter has a high-profile job and hates it, but won't leave. The woman pulled out her phone, and the alien squinted through the plethora of germs on the screen to see a smiling baby. He chuckled. Him and babies really were quite cute, despite being covered in a rainbow of microorganisms. The woman smiled, though the alien could sense her pain as tears welled in her eyes. She loves her daughter, but her granddaughter is everything to her. The alien listened attentively as the conversation turned to her neighborhood in D.C. "What would you like to drink, sir?" the flight attendant asked, interrupting 36C's restaurant recommendations. The alien looked at the beverage cart and then at the uncertain expressions of the flight attendant and the passengers in the rest of the row. His bones felt heavy with the weight of being constantly watched. The aroma of fresh coffee made his blood vibrate with excitement. He could taste the hot beverage on his lips, a feeling he had become a bit addicted to in a few months on Earth. But he did not want a drink served by her hands that had touched the seats and door handles and other hands that were all covered in grime. The humans pretended wasn't there, that he saw everywhere in vivid, radiant colors. "I'm okay, thank you," the alien said in his politest tone. She nodded and took 36C's drink order. The flight attendant held the drink out to the alien to touch, to pass to the woman 36C. The plastic cup was covered with a polychromatic layer of microbes. The alien knew if he refused to pass the drink, it would be a political disaster. Humans were extraordinarily talented at taking small, meaningless incidents and turning them into worldwide scandals. Another passenger would confront him, and there would be a video, and it would be everywhere. And the humans would turn it into another reason to hate aliens, and his talks would quickly derail. He couldn't afford one single mistake. They needed the humans to trust him. His blood recoiled, skin rolling in waves as he took the drink and placed it on 36C's tray table. The woman smiled at him, and it was the first time any human had smiled at him in a genuine way. He wished that this woman lived closer to her granddaughter, that she didn't have dreadful cough that all humans would eventually have. Maybe these humans weren't all terrible. For the first time, he felt a pang of guilt about what would happen to them.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.